Physics World.
Hello, welcome to Physics World Weekly. Coming up, we're celebrating the birthday of a European project that shone a bright light on a range of science over the past three decades. The European Synchrotron Radiation Facility, ESRF, in Grenoble was launched 30 years ago, providing scientists with a giant microscope to peer inside materials for physics, chemistry, biology, and many other fields. We'll be joined by John Cartwright, the editor of ESRF News, who'll talk about some of the facility's highlights and how a major new upgrade will keep the ESRF at the forefront of science. First, though, I'm joined by our general physics editor, Hamish Johnston, who's here to give us a roundup of some of the big stories on our website this week.
Hi, James.
Hi, Hamish. All right. So I know we've had loads and loads of rain recently in Bristol. I know you've got a story here about how raindrops form.
Yeah, we've got a story by Michael Allen. He's a regular contributor to Physics World. And the story has the headline, "Raindrop Formation in Turbulent Clouds is Observed at Long Last." And this looks at a possible solution to something that's called the size gap problem. And that's a sort of a problem with our understanding of how raindrops form in clouds. Now, we know that raindrops begin as tiny droplets that form by condensation in clouds. But the problem is that these droplets are very lightweight, and they remain suspended in the cloud, or at least they should. We don't know exactly how they grow to become big enough to fall out. And atmospheric physicists had thought that turbulence in the clouds tends to push these tiny droplets together, causing them to collide and coalesce. But there is little experimental evidence for this because it's very difficult, A, to look inside a cloud, or B, create a cloud in the lab. But now researchers at the College of Charleston in the US have flown an airplane-mounted imaging system through clouds, and they've actually observed this droplet clustering for the first time. So now we know the role of turbulence in causing it to rain. And I have to say, yesterday, it must have been very turbulent up there because we had an incredible amount of rain
and a
bit of flooding as well in Bristol. Yeah.
So another very popular topic on our website is graphene, and there's another breakthrough this week, isn't there?
Yeah, this staying on the theme of water, graphene, it's a sheet of carbon just one atom thick, and scientists have been very keen on using it as a filter. The idea is you've got a very, very thin sheet that's very strong, and if you can poke tiny holes through it, then you could purify water. You know, if the holes are too small for viruses or bacteria to get through, you've got a very effective filter. The problem is that it's been difficult to come up with a process of creating a sheet of graphene with the appropriate pores made in it. But in an article called "Graphene Filters Go Large," Belle Dume describes how researchers in Switzerland and Korea have developed two new processes to make graphene filter membranes with pores that are smaller than 100 nanometers across. Unlike previous attempts, these processes should be amenable to mass production. And as well as providing a way to remove bacteria and viruses from drinking water, these membranes could also be used in biomedical applications, making wearable electronics, and also making breathable fabrics. So the next time you're out in the rain, you might have a raincoat made from graphene with pores in it, courtesy of some researchers in Switzerland and Korea.
So talking of biomedical applications, I understand we also had a story about optical sensors being used to monitor brain activity. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. We've got, it's a news article called "Transient Optical Sensors Monitor Brain Health Before Dissolving Away." And this describes, now I'm going to have to pause to make sure I pronounce this properly, a bioresorbable brain implant that was created by engineers and neurosurgeons in the US, China, and Korea. This implant will allow doctors to monitor a patient's glucose and blood oxygenation levels following surgery. After it's no longer needed, it'll simply dissolve away, unlike permanent devices that are used today and require surgery to remove. So you can see why this could be very beneficial. Now, this article is written by Catherine Steffel. She's a PhD student contributor to Physics World, and she's based at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
So yeah, so the last story today involves bubbles, is that right?
Yeah, this is a bit of, fluid physics that could help us understand how bacteria spread and maybe help prevent certain diseases from occurring. It's a story about how bacteria may be manipulating bubbles that occur on the surface of contaminated water. Physicists at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology have shown that chemicals excreted by some microorganisms affect how bubbles burst. The team found that biosurfactants from the bacteria cause the bubbles to endure for longer times on water surfaces. And crucially, the liquid film that makes up the bubble can become very, very thin. Now, a very thin film, when it bursts, will produce lots and lots of tiny droplets that actually spray over a very large distance, potentially spreading the bacteria. This is described by Louisa Cockbill in an article entitled "Bacteria Manipulate Bubbles to Maximize Airborne Dispersal."
Now, on December the 10th, 1988, Cliff Richard's Christmas hit, Mistletoe and Wine, was sitting at the top of the UK music charts. Meanwhile, over in Paris, research ministers were most likely clinking their own glasses of Chardonnay, and they just officially signed off the project for the European Synchrotron Radiation Facility, better known as ESRF. 4 years later, the first users arrived at the newly built facility in Grenoble. And since then, studies at the ESRF have led to over 30,000 publications and 4 Nobel laureates. The December issue of ESRF News celebrates this anniversary and looks to the future after the facility's latest major upgrade. So we're joined now by the magazine's editor, John Cartwright, who can tell us all about the anniversary. Thanks for joining us, John.
Hi, James.
Welcome to IOP.
So I think it's probably best to start at the beginning, and perhaps you could explain to us what is a synchrotron.
So a synchrotron is any particle accelerator that accelerates charged particles in a circle. And when a charged particle changes direction, it emits electromagnetic radiation, which we call synchrotron radiation. A synchrotron could be a particle collider, like the famous Large Hadron Collider. But usually when we say synchrotron, we mean a synchrotron light source. The idea of a synchrotron light source is specifically to generate synchrotron radiation, which is usually X-ray radiation. Now, the idea with this is to channel that radiation and use it to study all sorts of materials, whether man-made or from the natural world. You can think of it a bit like an X-ray scanner you get in hospitals, except that it is way, way more powerful. In fact, the entire facility itself is about the size of a hospital. You can see into things much faster, more clearly, and at resolutions less than a thousandth of a millimetre.
I think for anybody who's visited Grenoble, the ESRF is very visible, isn't it? It's right at the end of a long peninsula between two rivers, and it's a big donut, isn't it? Presumably where the electrons go around.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess a lot of people will be familiar with Grenoble as the first stop on their way to a skiing holiday. But actually, Grenoble is a major science city. And in the northeast of that city, as Hamish was saying, there's this science campus where there's several major scientific infrastructures. So you've got the European Molecular Biology Laboratory, you've got the Institute of Structural Biology, you've got the Institut Langevin, the neutron source, and, of course, the ESRF, which is this big donut-shaped synchrotron light source. So, you know, under the azure skies and with snowy mountain peaks in the background, you can go to Grenoble and do some synchrotron science.
Yeah, it is incredible how much science is done in Grenoble, because there's also national labs there, there's universities, there's the French nuclear agency is based there as well. But what is it about ESRF? What is it that makes it so special? I think you wrote in the latest issue of your magazine that it's a third generation synchrotron. What does that mean?
Okay, so the ESRF does. It has a special place among synchrotron light sources. And to understand why, you just have to kind of think back to when synchrotron radiation was first used. And that's in the middle of last century. So back then, radiation, the synchrotron radiation, was just a byproduct or even a nuisance of machines whose primary purpose was to study particle physics interactions. A little later, the physicists realized that this radiation was so useful for experiments, it would be good to have synchrotrons dedicated to the generation of this synchrotron radiation. They called these ones the second generation synchrotrons. But somehow even these didn't quite satisfy scientists' ambitions. They wanted really bright, really focused X-rays. And the way to do that was to force the orbiting electrons around this circular ring into zigzag paths with magnetic devices known as undulators and wigglers.
So that's an official physics term, a wiggler.
Those are official physics terms, and they do what they say on the tin. The ESRF was the first synchrotron ever built using these devices, and so it was the first third-generation synchrotron. And this really did open up a whole new world of synchrotron science.
I was lucky enough to go back in 2013, and we made a few films about the facility and the science there. And I think one of the things that struck me was just the sheer range of science going on. So I met biologists, I met chemists, I met people in industry. I know in the anniversary issue, you've picked out as a magazine, you picked out some of the highlights from the past 30 years. I mean, are there any of those that really stood out for you as being particularly interesting?
Yeah, so it can be quite difficult to summarise what synchrotron light sources are used to study, because they, you know, it might be easy to ask what they don't study. It's often said that they're used to study the science of the everyday. What we mean by that is that they answer questions not about kind of abstract concepts like particle physics, but about things like biology or technology or health or the environment. So as you said, I mean, the ESRF has a lot of experimental science going on. There's been over 30,000 peer-reviewed papers. And some of the examples of these are quite impressive. So for instance, one of the things that the ESRF has studied are the structures and the function of biological molecules.
So there's like proteins and DNA and
exactly.
That sort of thing.
Exactly, yeah. And because of the brightness of its X-rays, it has been able to expose these structures and uncover the structures of some really, really complex proteins. And one of these in particular was the ribosome. And this is the molecular machine that oversees the creation of other proteins in our bodies. For that structure, the ESRF uses Ada Yonath and Venki Ramakrishnan, and as well as their late colleague Thomas Stites, won the 2009 Nobel Prize in Chemistry.
Ramakrishnan, is he president of the Royal Society now?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right.
So another good example of what the ESRF has studied are cultural artifacts, so things like paintings, ancient objects, that sort of thing. By studying the composition of these objects, you can not only work out how they were made, but you can also work out how best to preserve them. So in the past, the ESRF has studied samples of paintings by Van Gogh. It's sampled ancient Egyptian glass. It's even had samples of the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yes, it must be incredibly careful bringing in those kind of artifacts.
Oh yes. I mean, these are just samples they've taken. They're not the entire objects. But nonetheless, yes, you have to be fairly careful with what you're doing. There's just one final example I wanted to give, which many people won't even have thought of, but synchrotrons like the ESRF are also tremendously important for industry. So all sorts of consumer products have been developed in conjunction with synchrotron experiments. You know, whether it's washing detergent or car tyres, pharmaceutical drugs or food, I mean, you name it, it's amazing how much science goes into these things.
So, you say, I mean, in that sort of case, if you've got a company that's developing a product,
Are they obligated to sort of provide their results to the public, or is there an element of the ESRF where people can effectively, or companies can buy time for their own private research?
Oh yeah, so I mean, companies can approach the ESRF, and one of the things the ESRF, you know, has to do is to establish a good relationship with the companies, so that you know, they won't always talk about the results that are published, and they have to sign various agreements so that the companies feel comfortable that they can go there. Because some of these products, you know, that you might develop a product that has some groundbreaking new property, you don't necessarily want to share that with your competitors. Mm. So, you know, they've had to be quite careful in how these things are arranged.
Yeah.
And I remember visiting ESRF a few years ago, and, you know, of course you've got the ring in the middle, but then on the outside of the ring, it's a bit, is it a bit like an octopus? You've got all these beam lines coming off, and some of the beam lines are highly specialized, aren't they? Some are designed for studying certain types of materials, and there are people, I remember meeting people, you know, who are sort of beamline specialists who took care of, you know, the beamline and the experiments.
I suppose it's important because a lot of scientists would be coming in, wouldn't they, perhaps just for a few weeks, and then maybe not familiar with that technology. They're more sort of coming from a background of being interested in the scientific questions. So, yeah, I guess it's really important that you have that support there on hand.
Absolutely. I mean, so you're right, Hamish. So they have the way this radiation comes off, it comes off tangentially to the beam, and it's channeled into different experimental stations, and we call these beam lines. The ESRF has 44 beam lines, and each one of those is really tailored to a kind of specific kind of range of experiments that can be performed. So that could be something like, as we talked about earlier, the elucidating the structure of biological molecules, in which case, you know, you might be wanting to take loads and loads and loads of samples, and there's a lot of mechatronics, a lot of robotics that goes into that to make it much more efficient. Or another type of beamline, for instance, might be more concerned with seeing physical mechanisms that take place over vastly different length scales. So it might be a beamline that's tailored to see not just very, very, very tiny things, but also slightly bigger things, and see how those different mechanisms interact with one another. So all these different beamlines, they have all sorts of different specialisms. I mean, there's even beamlines that look at things at extreme temperatures and pressures. Those could be useful if you are trying to understand processes that go on in the ground beneath our feet, you know, deep inside the Earth's structure. Or it could be also for chemical processes that take place in industry. You know, some of these chemical processes, these reactions require very high temperatures and pressures in order to proceed.
There's also a really interesting synergy, isn't there, between ESRF and the ILL neutron source, which is right next door, isn't it? And my understanding is that both of those facilities are very complementary. So there are things that you can work out using X-rays, but there are also different things that you can work out using neutrons. And so if you're lucky enough to be in Grenoble, you can sort of shuttle your sample back and forth between ESRF using X-rays, using neutrons, measuring lots and lots of different properties, and learning an incredible amount in a very short period of time. Mm. And then I suppose that there's even more synergies in Grenoble, isn't there? Because you've got the European Molecular Biology Lab has an outpost there. Yep. I mean, whenever I go there, it just seems like a science city. you know, does anything else go on in Grenoble besides fantastic science?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, they've got some nice restaurants. But you're right. I mean, it's very much, you know, there's a lot of students around, a lot of scientists. You know, it is a place for learning. And you know, it's set to become even better with this upgrade that's going on at the ESRF. That's been going on. That started about a decade ago, and the cost was something like 330 million euros. but we're now approaching the second phase of that upgrade, which essentially involves creating an entirely new synchrotron source in the present ESRF building.
And that's called the Extremely Brilliant Source? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I don't know where you go from there with the next, with the next upgrade.
Again, they don't tend to mess around with the with the names of these things. So what makes this one will make it very special is that it will be the first high-energy fourth-generation synchrotron light source. So it was the first third-generation synchrotron light source. It's now going to be the first high-energy fourth-generation synchrotron light source. And it can get a bit complicated, this, but basically what we have currently in the ESRF storage ring is something called a double-bend achromat lattice. And that means that there's two bending magnets in every single cell that makes up that storage ring. But the new storage ring will have seven bending magnets, and so it's called a multi-bend achromat lattice. Now, I'll skip the kind of any further technical details, but the net result is that you get something 100 times brighter and 100 times more tightly confined. And I suppose the result of that is even more impressive science. So, I mean, if you think of the original synchrotrons as being something like an X-ray torch, if you like, the EBS, the extremely brilliant source, will be more like an X-ray laser.
So are there any, I mean, it's probably too early to talk about specific projects, but are there any fields of science and technology that will now open up as a result of the upgrade?
Yeah, so I mean, yeah, you're right. I mean, we can't talk about specific experiments yet, but you know, really, the world is your oyster if you're a scientist who's interested in studying materials. So you'll be able to, for example, you could film biological processes across different length scales. You could image in three dimensions massive objects. I mean, think of things like the skull of a T-Rex or a car engine. I mean, these are the sorts of things you'll be able to image in really unprecedented detail. You could also study the electronic and magnetic behavior of materials while, again, exposing them to extreme pressures and temperatures. But broadly speaking, you'll be able to do experiments faster and you'll be able to do a lot more of them.
And the timescale here sounds, well, you know, who am I to comment on how long it takes to replace an accelerator? But it's going to take 20 months to pull out the existing synchrotron and put a new one in. That sounds...
Seems fast.
It's very ambitious, yeah.
Well, you know, there's obviously been a lot of preparation underway. There's a separate building next to the main ESRF building in which they've been assembling all the magnets that will constitute this new source. And I believe they've just finished constructing all those magnets. So what will happen in the next week or so is that the ESRF, the present storage ring, that is, will switch off, and it will be steadily deconstructed, and then they'll construct the new storage ring in its place. And the challenge there is, I mean, you know, they've had to design a new storage ring that fits in exactly the same space as the existing one. So whether it's theoretically or practically, there's not really that much room for manoeuvre.
Can I say, in the anniversary issue, you've got a really nice pullout here with a timeline of the key events, and you've also got some really nice quotes from people from the world of physics and, you know, related areas to this. And you got a nice quote here from somebody who's involved, well, the director, actually, of the SESAME project, which is going to be it's a planned synchrotron for the Middle East.
Mm. Is that in Lebanon?
Is that right?
In Jordan.
So I just wondered, I mean, does the ESRF see itself, especially with this upgrade, as a real kind of, you know, the world-leading synchrotron that can kind of inspire and support all the other facilities around the world?
Well, it's certainly one of its kind in the sense that it's going to be the first high-generation fourth-generation synchrotron source, but it won't be the only fourth-generation synchrotron source. And in fact, the person who designed the new source, Pantelio Raimondi at the ESRF, his design is what has inspired other places around the world to develop their fourth generation synchrotron sources. But I think, you know, I think the ESRF thinks of itself very much as part of a community as opposed to being, you know, right, you know, a leader of, you know, a leader in terms of organizing things. Its work, you know, its help with the SESAME synchrotron in Jordan is part of a sort of collaborative effort to try and just help a community form in a region of the world where there isn't a community to begin with, and help them to try and reap some benefits of that.
So it sounds like a really, really interesting project anyway, the Sesame project. So yeah, it'd be good to keep an eye on that one.
So there's going to be no light from ESRF for 20 months.
What are the scientists doing?
Is the plan to upgrade some of the beam lines, sort of modernize some of the other facilities at ESRF?
Well, yeah, I mean, you're quite right. I mean, during this time when they're building a storage ring, you obviously can't, there's not going to be many X-rays coming out of that storage ring. So you won't be able to do, I guess, for want of a better word, your sort of traditional synchrotron science. But as you know, I mean, you know, it's not all about data collecting. And a lot of the scientists who use the ESRF will still be analyzing data that they've been taking over the last year or so. And there's, you know, there's other things you can do at the ESRF other than just purely synchrotron science. So, for example, there's a newly installed cryo-EM facility, which is another way of uncovering the structures of biological macromolecules. And this is a facility. It's not the only one in the world. There's more and more places are installing them, but it's becoming much more popular as a way to uncover structures of biological macromolecules, and I think a lot of people will be using that in the meantime.
So cryo-EM, does EM stand for electron microscope?
Absolutely. So it's a cryogenic electron microscope. So essentially you're freezing the biological macromolecules rather than having to attempt to crystallize them in the traditional matter. And that just, it can make it a bit easier to get big structures when things are just a bit, they don't like to be crystallized, I suppose. I have to admit, I'm not, as a physicist, I approach these topics with a little bit of caution when I'm describing them.
It probably an interesting couple of years for you then, sort of covering slightly different studies and different stories, I guess.
I know, yeah. I mean, it's definitely been a learning experience. Coming from a physics background, we're now often reporting on things like quantum mechanics or cosmology or whatever, and learning about, to be honest, some areas of science that are sort of moving at much faster paces. Biology, molecular biology. You know, I did a special issue a year ago on paleontology at the ESRF, and before recently, the way you did paleontology was you had a fossil, and if you wanted to understand what the structure of that fossil was, you had to break it apart. You had to literally destroy the fossil. But now you can take it to somewhere like the ESRF, and you can just stick it in the X-ray beam, and you know, hey presto, you've got this, you know, beautifully detailed 3D model, and the fossil is immaculately preserved.
Well, we went, yeah, we met a guy called, is it Paul Taffereau? I
don't know. Paul Taffereau, indeed,
so
yeah.
He pioneered, is it synchrotron microtomography, I think
yeah,
he called it.
Yeah,
so he's kind of creating slices and building up a 3D model, as you said. And it was really fascinating because, you know, you had obviously the imagery coming from the synchrotron, but there's lots of scope to kind of connect that with theories of evolution. Mm. And it was, you know, really, really fascinating, rich field of science.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's just one of many things that they're doing that, I mean, it's just so impressive, everything they do. I mean, it's you're sort of spoilt for choice in a way. I do 3 issues a year of the magazine, and, you know, it's a decision. What should we focus on this time?
You pop out to Grenoble a few times each year. You're a fan of the city. You mentioned the restaurants. Any other notable tourism spots?
Well, I have to confess that I sort of experienced the city a little bit to begin with, but now I tend to head straight for the campus, and there's a little hostel on the campus where me and various other visiting experimentalists live whilst we're at the Israel. It's a funny little place, but it's got a nice breakfast bar, and there's a restaurant on site that does good food. So it's got a little community of its own on the EPN campus.
Yeah, almost like a micro city there. Mm. Yeah,
and fantastic views as well. I mean, I remember going to a cafe that was just around the corner from ESRF, and you had this huge mountain sort of coming straight down.
I think we climbed that to get a shot looking down at the giant ring, which it looks like a big polo mint. That's the comparison
it does,
they always make. So there's a cable car which can take you up to the top, isn't there? So It's worth doing.
Yeah. Every time I go there, I think this time I'll take the cable car, but then work just takes precedence, unfortunately.
Here's an amazing fact, which I'm sure is wrong, and our listeners will tell us, but apparently Grenoble, is it the flattest city in France?
Apart from that massive hill.
Well, no. It's because it's along the Isère River, so it's very flat in the river bottom. And apparently the city limits don't extend up the sides of the mountains. Mm. So Grenoble proper is the supposedly the flattest city in France. I'm sure that's not true. And please do write in.
Maybe it's not a flood risk if it's sort of boxed in by the mountains. But, yeah.
It's lovely. I mean, if you've been to Boulder, Colorado, for example, I mean, I'm guessing some of our listeners have been to Boulder. It's a very similar situation. You know, you're surrounded by these huge chunks of rock, mountains, you know, that come almost right into town, but not into town. It's a beautiful place. And of course, skiing. Are you into skiing, John?
I've done it once. I might do it again if someone pushed me down a hill with snow on. I'm not a great skier, but I wouldn't mind doing some walks up in the Alps. That sounds the views must be breathtaking.
Yeah. Lovely stuff. All right. Well, thanks, John. Thanks for joining us today. And congratulations with the issue. And you can access that entire special 30th anniversary issue over at the ESOF website. And if you visit the Physics World website, I'll also share those films that I talked about that we produced back in 2013 about the ESOF. And don't forget, also on our website, you can find all those stories that Hamish spoke about earlier in the podcast. Also look out for our other podcast, which is called Physics World Stories. So this month, the host of that podcast, Andrew Glester, has produced an excellent programme all about gravitational waves and the dawn of multi-messenger astronomy.
I have to say, James, that Andrew really hit his stride with this podcast. I really enjoyed it. So I'd highly recommend that listeners have a go and listen to Andrew.
And that's part of it's a five-part series that he's producing connected in with Physics World's 30th anniversary, which also happens to be this year. Okay, and join us again next week. Bye.
Physics World.